From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Search and rescue crews put a pause on their work today in Surfside, Florida, 1 week after a luxury condo building collapsed and buried scores of residents under the rubble. Early this morning, workers noticed movement in a part of the building that's still standing. They're worried the structure and the mountain of debris at the base could collapse further.
President Joe Biden is on the site today in the role of consoler-in-chief, meeting families and rescuers after the bodies of two children, 4 and 10-year-old siblings, were found along with their parents in the rubble late last night. Tim Padgett is there for member station WLRN out of Miami, Florida. He's on his cell phone for us. And Tim, such a profoundly sad time already. Then these worries about the rest of the building falling, of course, long ago evacuated, but tell us more.
Well, the basic problem is that when a building like this implodes, the concrete is no longer concrete. It becomes more like dust. And that's one of the big things that the search and rescue workers have been dealing with here, is that what they're digging through has become so fine and so precarious that any sign like this, that decomposition of the material of the building could be forcing the building, that's the part of the building that's still intact, to come down as well, is just one of the biggest red flags that they can confront, and that's why they put this off.
Yeah, and last night these rescue crews found those two young sisters were a week into this effort, no survivors since the morning of the collapse. Now these rescuers have to just wait. What kind of toll is all this taking on them?
Oh, on the rescue, search and rescue workers, it takes an incredible toll. I've been covering earthquakes, for example, for 3 decades as a correspondent in Latin America, and I know that this sort of painstaking work, particularly when you feel as though it's not bearing any fruit in terms of either finding survivors or even finding victims, can really take a psychological toll on anyone, particularly in these conditions here. I mean, one of the saddest things about this in terms of the search and rescue work is that this happened in June in Miami, one of the hottest, wettest, stickiest, and most unsettling meteorological times for South Florida, and that's just made their work even harder and more of a psychological burden.
Yeah. Any sense of when it might start back up again, and might it be recovery instead of rescue?
Well, I think in many ways we really are into recovery phase in this. It's been more than a week now, and the way in which this building pancaked, as opposed to say an earthquake in a place like Haiti, where the implosion of a building is much more chaotic and does allow for more sort of air pockets and things like that, that can allow people inside the building to perhaps survive for days, if not weeks. That just doesn't appear here in this scenario in the way that this building came down. So I think in many ways, the search and rescue teams already are in recovery mode. And although the officials here are still stressing that this is search and rescue, which is understandable, they want to make sure that these families know that they are still looking for the possibility that anyone might have survived this.
Right. Well, in addition to everything else, there are now fears of a tropical storm on its way, high winds, rain. What's the talk about that, and how do rescuers prepare for that?
Well, the only way that they can prepare for that is to perhaps try to batten down a lot of the rubble that's there that they're searching through, so that if a storm passed through here, it doesn't make that precarious situation that I was talking about earlier even worse. Fortunately, it does not look like this tropical storm, Elsa, is going to make direct contact with South Florida. It's going to sort of skirt to the south of us, so it shouldn't be a major problem. And I think once that has passed, then they'll be able to start in earnest again early next week.
And just briefly, Tim, President Biden, as we said, is meeting with those rescue teams, with families. You know, sometimes presidents are so welcomed at tragedies like this, and sometimes, you know, they're not. I mean, what is your sense of what he's accomplishing there?
Well, I think there are two groups of relatives of the victims. There is a group that is still holding out hope that survivors can be found, and I think for them, President Biden's visit may be more of a nuisance. But there is another group that has come to the resignation, let's say, that they have lost their loved ones. And I think they feel that President Biden's visit will be a morale booster, and not just a morale booster, but also a way to find out how the federal government is going to be helping them from here on out.
Tim Padgett of WLRN, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, this is an important day for the new Federal Trade Commissioner, Lina Khan, who is presiding today over the first open meeting of her tenure. She's already made enemies, and that's because Khan has argued that Amazon and other big companies should be broken up. Here she is in her confirmation hearing this April.
I've been quite public about my concerns about concentrated power in the context of digital markets. We're continuing to see a whole range of potential risks.
Let's take a deeper look with NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond. Shannon, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
So Lina Khan is 32 years old. She's the youngest FTC commissioner ever, and she's been an outspoken critic of big tech. What else do we need to know about her?
Yeah, really, in just the past few years, she's emerged as one of the most prominent voices calling for aggressive curbs on the dominance of big companies. I spoke to Barry Lynn. He's the director of the Open Markets Institute. That's a left-leaning think tank that's really helped lead this charge against monopolies, and it's where Lina Khan worked early in her career.
What we can say for sure is that Lina's coming to this with a very fresh way of thinking, which is grounded in the fundamental principles of the American democracy.
Now, when Khan was still a law student, she really made her name in antitrust and tech policy circles with this paper about Amazon, in which she argued that antitrust law as currently applied just doesn't account for the vast power of this big retailer, right? And calling for a much broader view of the potential harms. That's really been the focus of her career. She advised the House Judiciary Committee during the sweeping probe it did of Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. That resulted in a report that Lina Khan helped write last year, concluding all four of those companies are monopolies and urging, in some cases, for them to be broken up.
Hmm. So just how far does she want to go to reshape the way that the government regulates large companies?
Well, she is part of this movement of academics, lawyers, policy experts that really want to see an overhaul of the approach to taking on big monopolies. They point to the concentration of corporate power in many sectors, including tech, and they say, look, it's not enough to ask, are prices lower for consumers? That is how courts and regulators have largely looked at antitrust since the 1970s. Khan and others, they want to revive this more muscular approach to antitrust, sort of from the trust-busting of the progressive era, right? Looking at the harms of corporate power, not just to consumers, but to other companies, rivals, employees, customers, and suppliers in the larger economy. This is this perspective that critics have sort of have cast as hipster antitrust.
Yeah, and that philosophy feels and sounds very, very different from the way the FTC has worked under past administrations.
That's right. I mean, of course, you know, under the Trump administration, the FTC did sue Facebook for antitrust. That was a big move. There are FTC commissioners, Democratic appointees, who have also taken this line, this more aggressive approach to antitrust. But that has not really been the powerful voice in the agency. You know, back in 2013, during the Obama administration, the FTC actually investigated Google over antitrust, but declined to bring charges. So now we're seeing this real shift, this view of monopoly power that Khan represents, you know, is really coming to the fore. And it's not just her. There are other anti-monopoly critics, too. Law professor Tim Wu is now at the White House National Economic Council. So this is gaining really prominence and sway under the Biden administration.
But what they're trying to do won't be easy. We reported this week on a judge's decision to toss out the FTC's antitrust lawsuit against Facebook. The judge said that the agency didn't prove its case. So what is Khan and the FTC up against here?
Yeah, I mean, the judge basically agreed with Facebook's argument saying this should be dismissed because saying it was as if the agency expected the court to nod to the conventional wisdom that Facebook is a monopolist rather than like show their work, right? Now the court has given the FTC 30 days till the end of this month, July, to refile the suit. They're going to have to give a lot more specifics to be able to advance these claims against Facebook.
Yesterday, Amazon asked for her recusal from their antitrust cases before the agency. What else are we hearing from her critics or big companies that don't like the direction she's taking this agency?
I mean, Amazon has been the most outspoken, right? And it's the company that Lina Khan has been most associated with as a critic. Amazon also pointed to her broader work, the work she did at Open Markets, at the House Judiciary Committee. That work took aim at a lot of different companies, not even just in tech. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of critics. None of them have been as outspoken as Amazon. You know, when I asked former FTC chair and general counsel Bill Kovacic about the Amazon petition, he said, you know, this issue was surely something the agency would have examined very carefully when Khan was nominated. He thought the petition was mainly a distraction, but she's certainly a target, right? And she's had these very public views about monopoly power. And now, you know, she is in charge of regulating many of these companies.
NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Best-selling author and professor Ibram X. Kendi has convened a national conversation on being anti-racist. He's the director for anti-racist research at Boston University. He's written the best-selling 2019 book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, where he points out the difference between not being racist and being anti-racist. We'll talk about that. Actively exposing racist ideals, working to end them. But now Dr. Kendi is convening a literal conversation with Be Anti-Racist with Ibram X. Kendi, what he calls an action podcast in which he explores the intersections of racism with other areas of bias. In this week's episode, CNN anchor Don Lemon talks about being both a black man and a gay man.
I didn't want to come out for the longest time because I was already black. And I said, okay, I'm black. Do I really need another strike? Now I welcome it because it's made me who I am.
Don Lemon in conversation with Professor Ibram Kendi on Kendi's podcast, Be Anti-Racist. And he joins us now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me back.
And in preparation, I was looking back at your so thought-provoking book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, in which you lay out the difference between different types of racism, but you also say a racist is someone who supports racist policies by their actions or inactions, not doing something. An anti-racist is someone who's supporting anti-racist policies by their actions or by expressing an anti-racist idea. Can you flesh that out a bit?
Sure. So you have ideas of racial hierarchy that, let's say, black people are lazier than white people. That's a racist idea. And so when somebody says that, they're being racist. You know, you have other ideas like, you know, there are these different cultures and all these cultures are equals. That's an anti-racist idea. And so when someone says that, they're being anti-racist. You have policies that make it harder for, let's say, black, brown, and indigenous people to vote. Those are racist policies and people support them and oppose them. And if they support them, they're being racist. And if they oppose them, they're being anti-racist.
Yeah. So that sets the table because you also go on to say, you know, for those who might think, well, I'm not racist because I'm not, you know, it just, I am not. That doesn't count. You're calling on people to be anti-racist, to actively do something about the racism that you see. Is that part of what you're doing? You call this an action podcast. Is that one way you felt maybe you had to walk your talk?
Exactly. I mean, for me, I'm always trying to think about how I could help people, even help myself, to sort of see the pathway to creating equity and justice. You know, nearly 200 years ago, there were people in Boston who were abolitionists who recognized that they needed to speak out and organized against slavery. They recognized that if we did not speak out against slavery, then it would persist. And so it's the same thing today, that if we aren't speaking out against racism, if we're not speaking out against the problem of racial inequity, what's going to happen to it? It's going to persist.
Yeah. Well, that gets us to the podcast. Each one, as we said, has an intersection between racism and other biases. So when you spoke to Don Lemon, he spoke about being both a gay man and a black man, which gives bigots reason to attack him on two fronts. What was your thinking behind that, the intersection?
I want people to sort of see and understand how racism shows up in different ways and intersects with other forms of bigotry. So whether it's, you know, I spoke with Rebecca Coakley about the way racism intersects with ableism, or with Ari Berman, who we talked about voter suppression, and certainly with Don Lemon, in which we talked about the way in which racism and homophobia harms, you know, black gay men like Don Lemon, as well as, you know, other queer people of color. And I also wanted people to hear this from the experts. There are so many different experts who are studying different forms of racism that I really wanted to usher to the American people.
Yeah. You mentioned speaking to disability rights activist Rebecca Coakley about ableism. This is judging people based on their physical or mental abilities. And you asked her how ableism intersects with racism. Let's listen to her answer.
They're roots of the same tree.
Yes.
It's funny. I actually went back through your book after reading it the first time. And every time there was something there that I was like, oh, it parallels here. I literally like drew a picture of a tree.
Well, and one of the parallels, Professor Kendi, is how being a Black person and a mentally disabled person make you more likely to be killed by police.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, even in that episode, I talked about my brother, who is a Black man with a disability. And I fear for my life, you know, around the police. But my fear for myself or my father pales in comparison. There's no one that I fear more, you know, around the police than my brother. And part of this is because I've seen the number of Black men and women with disabilities who've been killed by police or even are in prisons and incarcerated when they shouldn't.
Now, you tell the story at the beginning of that podcast about your brother calling the police for some reason and how you hurried over there.
Yeah, and it was one of the scariest moments of my life because, you know, my brother was having an episode and he called the police. My parents called me when the police showed up and I rushed over there and felt that I was rushing over there to potentially save my brother's life.
You mentioned journalist Ari Berman, who covers voting rights for Mother Jones. He talks about all these voter suppression bills as they're being characterized by most viewers. The people behind them say that they're strengthening the voting system. But Ari Berman says it's part of a larger strategy. Let's listen.
First, you try to undermine people's faith in the electoral process so they don't vote in the first place.
Yeah.
Then when they vote, you try to throw out their votes. And then when you can't throw out their votes, you then make it so that they have a harder time voting in the next election. I mean, this is a strategy here. This is a plan here. This is a roadmap here. I think a lot of people are not connecting one to the other to the other.
So Professor Kendi, let's say after that podcast, people do. How can somebody be anti-racist about what they view as racist voter suppression bills?
Well, they could call their elected officials and advocate for the For the People Act or the John Lewis voting rights bill that's coming down the pipe as well, or even advocate for more state-oriented bills that expand early voting, that allow people to register automatically, that allows election days to be holidays, and to thinking, okay, how can we make it easy for people, you know, to vote? Because the easier it is for people to vote, the more people are going to vote, and the more well-functioning our democracy will be.
Yeah. There's so many more topics in your podcasts. The collateral damage of racism on white people, that's with political commentator Heather McGee. Racism in sports with Jemele Hill, the sports commentator. She's had a run of her own. We remember when she was suspended for writing a column. I think she said something like having sympathy for the Celtics, Boston's basketball team in a, you know, this very, very white town, is like thinking that Hitler is a victim. What did she talk about with sports and racism?
Well, I think we're living in a new time in which more and more athletes are refusing to just shut up and dribble or to shut up and just catch or run the football. And they're really speaking out and they're really using their voice and they're really demanding their power. And she was really able to share how and why that's happening and how and why it's important for people to support the efforts of athletes to speak out and to use their platforms for racial justice and even to gain more power within their leagues and within their sport. Because for so long, particularly Black athletes, there's been all sorts of ways in which they've been confined and controlled. And that is what caused, you know, even a sports writer named William Roden to write a book called $40 Million Slaves.
Professor Kendi, it feels like that your work is directed quite a bit towards people who think they're not racists, but you're nudging to be more than that, to take action. Same with the podcast. how do you address the people who are on the other side of the political divide, maybe are racist proudly, or have racist beliefs but would be offended if they were told that? I mean, there's such a divide right now. It feels like, I said, that a lot of these conversations are happening on one side of that divide.
Well, there is a divide, and there are people who hold racist ideas and believe those ideas are the truth. But some of those people are open-minded, and so they just maybe haven't been exposed to a different way of seeing or knowing in the world. They haven't really been exposed to evidence that demonstrates that what they think is not the case. For those people who are open-minded, who are willing to read from people who study racism, you know, obviously I'm supplying and seeking to supply that. But then there are other people who aren't closed, are very closed. And for me, it's almost as if they're addicted to racist ideas. And so it's hard for anyone to get them to confront themselves and their addiction. And so it's really incumbent upon them and the people who are close to them. And so I may not be able to get them to think differently, but if I can get their family member who then is able to sort of work with them to really overcome this belief that racial inequality is normal, then to me, that's a job well done.
That's Professor Ibram X. Kendi. He's, of course, the widely read author, but his new podcast is Be Anti-Racist with Ibram X. Kendi. We'll hook you up at hearandnow.org. Professor, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, as always.
The first podcast series to ever win a Pulitzer Prize, NPR's No Compromise.
We dive into the political movement that's driving extreme gun rights activism and more. I'm Chris Haxel.
And I'm Lisa Hagen. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The world's leading oil-producing countries in OPEC and their allies met today to discuss policy and pricing as demand for fuel grows. Oil market outlooks seem more optimistic as pandemic restrictions ease, but many countries are still trying to get a handle on COVID-19 and its impact on the global economy. And here in the U.S., what about us? As many Americans look to travel this weekend, let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Hey, good to be back with you.
Well, good to have you. Producing countries, we know they can turn the spigot on and off. It can get political, but OPEC, you know, is supposed to keep things stable. So who was at this meeting? And did they come to an agreement?
Well, so this is, you know, it's different than it was in the 70s and 80s, in which OPEC was such a big player. OPEC is still a gathering of countries. It's the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. They're still very, very influential in turning that spigot of oil on, which reduces prices, or off, which increases prices. There are also a number of non-OPEC partners to OPEC. When you put it together, it's called OPEC Plus, and they are some of the world's most powerful oil producers. They're still working out the details about how to deal with how much production to add in order to lower prices. If you recall, over the last year and a half, we've used so little oil in the world that everybody's reduced the output to keep prices higher. Now prices are finally going up.
Right. And so what's the, you know, the forecast for the future for the oil market? What is the thinking?
Well, it's generally good. Demand in the second half of this year, which starts today, will be 5 million barrels per day higher than in the first 6 months of the year, which was higher than last year. So we know things are going up, but we've got this Delta variant going around the world. A lot of countries have had no vaccination, so a lot of problems. So they're a little bit worried about this. So what we're thinking that these OPEC plus countries will do is boost production by probably under 500,000 barrels a day, which sort of allows for more in consumption, more people buying oil, but it doesn't flood the market in a way that collapses oil prices.
Right. And can you be more specific for, you know, maybe Americans traveling for the 4th, you know, coming up, or, yeah, you know, who have road trips through the summer?
Well, you remember in 2008, crude oil hit $140 a barrel. We had hurricanes, we had shortages, we had all sorts of things. It had all sorts of things. Once you get above $100 a barrel, people actually make decisions to drive less, to carpool, to buy different cars. So oil companies want as much money as they can get per barrel of oil without turning people off. Now, we do have a problem because gas prices in this country are averaging $3.12 a gallon right now. That's a problem because that's a 7-year high, just as a whole bunch of people are hitting the road for the first time, you know, for a major holiday for July 4th. So this is where it starts to become an issue. $3.12 a gallon is much higher than oil has historically been, much higher than it's been in the last 7 years. And OPEC's going to be looking at that as well.
Yeah, because as you said, there wasn't a lot of it because they cut back on production because nobody was going anywhere. And now here we go. Is there going to be a moment where they say this signals that everything's stabilized again?
Yeah, so oil demand across the world fell by more than 30% during the lockdowns a year ago. It's now back to about 95% of pre-COVID highs. So, you know, we're almost back there. But there are new COVID restrictions going into place in some parts of the country. So, you know, we'll hear about this probably in the next few months when OPEC says, all right, things are back to normal.
Keep some cash on hand for gas. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Thank you.
Okay.
Two House committees are investigating the Food and Drug Administration's approval of a controversial new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. The drug, Aduhelm, was developed by Biogen for patients with mild cognitive impairment. It's intended to slow the progression of the disease. And now, in a detailed report, our partners at STAT describe Biogen's questionable relationship with regulators at the FDA, which may have helped get the drug approved. Damian Garde is one of the STAT reporters who's been looking into this. Damian, welcome.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So the drug at the center of this story, as I said, it's controversial in and of itself. There's no clear evidence that it actually works. So why don't we start there?
Yeah, exactly. So Biogen, the company that invented it, enrolled two very large clinical trials to really determine, as you said, you know, can it delay the cognitive and functional decline that comes with Alzheimer's? In the process of running those studies, the company made a fateful and serious mistake. They were hoping to get an answer as soon as possible, so they had independent advisors take an early look at data to determine whether this was all going to be futile, whether the drug wasn't going to work. And those advisors said, yeah, it looks like it is going to be futile, so they canceled it. Within weeks, as Biogen started to actually look at the data from these studies, it appeared that in one study, the drug worked as it was supposed to. And in another study, which had failed, you know, you could look at it, you could look at certain patients. There were signals, at least a hint, that there was an effect there. And that's kind of where our story begins, actually, is in the spring of 2019.
So fair to say, then, that there are real questions about its efficacy. Now, that was a problem for the company because when the news came out that the drug was being shelved at that time, Biogen's stock fell 30%. How serious was this as a potential setback for Biogen?
I mean, in the context of Biogen, this is a large biotech company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that had become incredibly successful by developing medicines for multiple sclerosis and later for the rare disease spinal muscular atrophy. But by 2019, those medicines had started to stagnate in terms of the money they were making. So there was serious pressure on Biogen from investors to turn this Alzheimer's treatment into a blockbuster. And so, you know, you can imagine declaring basically failure on what was meant to be your biggest drug did not go over well on Wall Street.
And so they kept pushing. Tell me about Project Onyx and their attempts to get this through the FDA anyway.
Right. So immediately upon going over the data from those, you know, allegedly failed studies, they saw, as I mentioned, these hints that the drug actually worked. And so thus began what we learned was called Project Onyx, the you know, kind of understandable internal effort to rescue this drug. Where things get fascinating is where the FDA comes into play. So Biogen's head neurologist had a meeting, a sort of off-the-books meeting, with a leading FDA official in its neurology department in the spring of 2019, basically to tell him, hey, we think we have a way to get this thing approved. And what we learned from talking to people, you know, in and around Biogen at that time is that this FDA official, Billy Dunn, was very taken with this case and basically became Biogen's ally within the FDA. But starting in the summer of 2019, the FDA became, you know, less like an adversarial regulator and more like a partner, kind of holding Biogen's hand through the process of analyzing these data and then, of course, actually approving the drug.
But why? Why was the FDA holding Biogen's hand through this process if the science was so unclear?
You know, we've talked to a lot of people with a lot of opinions on that, and I think what it comes down to for people around the situation at that time, you know, we have to remember that it had been nearly two decades since there had been a new treatment approved for Alzheimer's disease. The FDA, facing that 20-year drought, looked at this, the next best option compared with what was out there, and thought, we need to do everything in our power to figure out a way to push this thing forward. And you know, even getting into the inside baseball of the FDA, what we learned from some FDA documents is that the neurology department came to look to its colleagues in cancer. You know, if you think about cancer drugs, the FDA doesn't often wait until they've proved to actually extend survival. They're often willing to approve new cancer drugs based on whether they can shrink tumors, because it, you know, stands to reason that if it shrinks tumors, if it makes cancer go away, that patients will survive longer. They were trying to apply that same logic to neuroscience. That formed the logic for them approving the Biogen drug, because it has an effect on plaques within the brain that are thought to drive Alzheimer's. The issue, and where all the controversy comes in, is that, you know, the scientific linkage between those plaques and Alzheimer's disease is not nearly as strong as the scientific linkage between tumors and dying of cancer. And that kind of gets us to all of the backlash that has ensued.
So, right, what are the ethical questions? You know, whether you spoke with people at the FDA or inside of Biogen, I mean, were people concerned about the special attention that the FDA had given the company?
You know, I think it was kind of polarizing. I can tell you that, you know, academics, former FDA people, and those who really believe that the FDA should maintain this gold standard were, I mean, one person said horrified by this, the closeness of this relationship. I think, you know, other people, especially within the drug industry and in some parts of science, are at least sympathetic to the FDA, facing, as I mentioned, the pressures that they have. I think a lot of people were very upset with Biogen for the mistake they made in canceling these trials. And we spoke to a lot of people who had worked on this drug while they were at Biogen. And virtually all of them believe that it does help patients, at least in some way. And they were very disappointed that even though it won approval, which is what they wanted for so many years, because of Biogen's actions and then in some ways because of the FDA's decision and the controversy that that's led to, it was almost bittersweet. Like they wanted this, but not like this. And so that was kind of a fascinating aspect of reporting this story out.
You know, this story reminds me somewhat of the cozy relationship that we saw between Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration after the 737 MAX was involved in a couple of deadly crashes. And we had learned that the FAA had outsourced its oversight to Boeing itself. It just makes me wonder, hearing that story and now yours, whether these kinds of arrangements between federal regulators and private companies are kind of more common than we know.
I think you're right in that it gets to the decades-long concern about regulatory capture. The concern that in many cases, federal regulators are either underfunded or, you know, set up in such a way that these sort of symbiotic relationships with the industries they regulate become almost inevitable and can have consequences. In the case of FDA, I think it's a little more muddled. I mean, you know, FDA and industry does have that famous revolving door. I mean, the last FDA commissioner just took a job at a biotech venture capital firm. But, you know, in this case, I think with the FDA approving, the pressure to approve drugs earlier to get them into the hands of patients is in many cases coming from Congress. This pressure is often bipartisan. I mean, there's quite a few Republican senators and lawmakers have pushed for a more libertarian approach to drug approvals. But even, you know, on the Democratic side, there are quite often, you know, patient groups testifying before Congress saying we need treatments for this severe disease. So I guess our story kind of fits within a long series of events by which the FDA has been cheered in many cases for loosening the standards for new therapies. But every now and again, and I think that's the case with this one, it does what it seems to think people want, and then people are quite upset.
Damien Gardet is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Damien, thank you very much for this story. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
A bit of starlight on a summer night from our friends at Star and Telescope. The magazine is reporting that after a long pandemic pause, star parties are back. One of the biggest and most popular stargazing events of the year is in Springfield, Vermont. It's called Stellafane, and this summer, astronomers of all ages will gather in early August to peer up at the Dome of Heaven, each one chasing a nebulae or constellation in the moonless sky. When the pandemic hit, a lot of star parties went virtual, which was creative, but not nearly as much fun, if you ask me. And this year, organizers in Vermont say no need to wear a mask to Stellafane if you're fully vaccinated. And if you're too far away from New England, Star and Telescope has compiled a list of star parties that are ready to launch this summer in towns across the United States and Canada.
Victoria's Secret is getting a major makeover, saying goodbye to its famous angel models who'd walk down runways with huge, beautiful wings and very little else.
Roll tape. What is Victoria's Secret in 3, 2, 1, go.
Off and running. Rock and roll.
Victoria's Secret was an escape for some, out of touch for many. Sales declined, and the company said it's revamping its look with a new, diverse group of ambassadors, including some of the world's biggest names, actress Priyanka Chopra Jones and soccer star Megan Rapinoe, among others. Cora Harrington is the founder of The Lingerie Addict. That's the world's largest online lingerie blog. Yes, this is a very big business. She joins us from New York on what happens to be her birthday. So, Cora, happy birthday. We hope you're wearing something special under there.
Thank you.
And your thoughts on this rebranding. Were you surprised?
I would say that the rebranding is overdue. I didn't expect Victoria's Secret to rebrand. They've been so entrenched, I believe, in their previous brand image, but it was definitely necessary. It was definitely overdue. And now we just have to wait to see how effective it is.
Well, it's not easy. You know, rebranding never is. But now, you know, swapping out, you know, winged angels for activists. So tell us more about why you weren't surprised and why you think it's overdue.
For years, I've been saying that Victoria's Secret needed to update their image. We had, a total shift in the tide in the conversation with the launch of the Airy Real campaign in 2014, which had people thinking differently about what they wanted from models, what they wanted to see from brands. And since then, we've had, I believe, repeated iterations on that theme, culminating in Rihanna's Savage X line, which brought an alternative version of sexy, an alternative vision of a fashion show to the masses, one that was so much more diverse and so much more resonant, I think, with customers than the Victoria's Secret model.
Well, you know, it is astonishing. I love my catalogs. You know, Prana, Title IX. Suddenly, there are women who look like women. You know, they look like people you know. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it happened overnight, and it seems perfectly normal now. So it was a shift in the marketing, obviously, but also a shift in what people want. Talk about that. You mentioned one company.
Mm-hmm.
There's others, Third Love, True & Company, that seem to be reflecting more about how women want to shop for underwear, but also what women want, not a push-up bra, but a sports bra.
We've seen a definite shift in the lingerie conversation towards comfort, towards people wearing what makes them feel like the best version of themselves, rather than being told what they should wear for others, how they should want to look. And I would say that attitude, that positional intimate apparel has further increased, has become even more apparent during the year of the pandemic or since the time of the pandemic when everyone was focused on comfort. Everyone was at home. We were wearing loungewear. We were wearing bralettes. And the Victoria's Secret brand was not built on you wearing these products to feel like the best version of yourself. It was built on you wearing these products to feel sexy. And right now, people who wear lingerie want to be told you're sexy and desirable and attractive as is. You don't need to look like a supermodel to be attractive. You're okay as you are.
Yeah. Look, the Washington Post took a deep dive into this. They noted other reasons, the decline of malls where the Victoria's Secret stores are.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the relationship with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself while in jail, who managed the finances of Leslie Wexner, who was founder of the Victoria's Secret parent company, L Brands. And Epstein used to pass himself off as a Victoria's Secret model recruiter. He was not. So that tainted the company. Do you think Victoria's Secret can come back?
I'm really not sure. So many customers have left the brand. Victoria's Secret is in the unenviable position of being a brand people want to see fail. And that's going to be really difficult to overcome. And the thing they have on their side is still their size, still their presence in the market. They're not going to disappear overnight. I don't believe they're going to have a lot of consumers coming back, but maybe they'll be able to attract new customers.
And Cora, we've been talking about Victoria's Secret, given them a lot of airtime. We've named some other companies. You who watch this industry, just tick off a few that women might want to check out for the reasons you mentioned. They seem to care about their customers, and they're offering things like comfort.
Mm-hmm. I would say Aerie is one such company. They really initiated a change in the way people talked about laundry and the way people saw it and what they expected from models. Of course, Savage X Fenty by Rihanna is on the tip of everyone's tongue when it comes to intimate apparel right now. They've become known for having a diverse range of models. We also see, I would say, industry stalwarts like, say, Elomi, which specializes in those plus-size bras for larger busts that are doing more as well, I would say, in terms of attracting more diverse consumers. So the wonderful thing about being into lingerie right now is that there are more options than ever before. And that's also going to be part of what Victoria's Secret has to overcome. They're not the only game in town anymore. Customers can choose to go somewhere else.
That's Cora Harrington, founder of The Lingerie Addict, the world's largest online lingerie blog. Cora, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was taking notes. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.